I call the meeting of the March 18th, 2026 meeting of the House Public Safety Committee to order. A quorum is present. Before beginning our meeting, I want to remind everyone that our committee chair maintains control of this hearing, and I have the following expectations. Signs and placards are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Applause or other audible demonstrations are not allowed. For safety purposes, standing or sitting in the walkways and aisles or standing or obstructing at your seat is prohibited. If you require any accommodations, please speak with our sergeant staff identified by the gold ties. Troopers and house security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety. If you received an entrance ticket, please retain it as it might be required for re-entry if you leave the hearing room. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in the removal from the hearing room. Thank you to the Sergeant-at-Arms who maintain their presence and helping maintain decorum in the committee room. Representative Duran, have you read the minutes of the meeting?
I have not.
Representative Engen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've read the meeting minutes.
Have you had a chance to review the minutes of the March 17th, 2026 meeting?
Yes, I have, and I move their adoption.
Representative Engen moves to approve the minutes of the March 17th, 2026 minutes. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion carries for the March 17th, 2026 meetings being approved. First bill on the agenda today is House File 3547. Chair Swazinski, please come forward to the testifier table. And do you have some testifiers?
I believe so. I'm not sure if they're in the room yet or not. If you want to come on up. Sorry, I missed you over there. Yes, Chris Swazinski, you want to move
I will move House File 3547 before the committee with the recommendation that it is re-referred to Elections, Finance, and Government Operations Committee. There are two amendments to the bill, but I'd first like to have you explain the bill, Representative Swazinski.
Explain the bill? Certainly. So it's no secret that in the state of Minnesota, we enjoy summer, we enjoy lake life, we enjoy all the trappings of what America truly is, and that's recreation. And, you know, one of the things we have done for decades and years is celebrate 4th of July with fireworks. The separation and the annual travel to other states to purchase said fireworks is part of that celebration. Whether you're driving to North Dakota, whether you're driving to South Dakota, whether you're driving to Iowa, whether you're driving to Wisconsin, to purchase the means to celebrate is part of that annual tradition to go to a lake. You also make a stop across state lines. And this is just a bill to celebrate the 250th anniversary of America. And what we can do is also drive policy and spending to meet some goals that we also have within the public safety community. That's what the bill does.
Thank you, Representative Swazinski. Can you have your testifier identify themselves and begin their testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Andrew Bellin. I live in Pine City, Minnesota. I am a Minnesota State licensed pyrotechnician. I have 10 years of experience with fireworks, three of them being with a professional display company doing shows around the state for cities. I am an aspiring small business owner, hoping to open a small retail firework business here in Minnesota in 2026. I'm here today to ask you to advance House File 3547. I understand that safety has been a concern in previous years. As a licensed operator, safety is my profession and my priority. But the reality is simple. Minnesotans are already lighting recreational fireworks, regardless of our current laws. Prohibition has not stopped use. It has only pushed sales across borders. We are losing significant revenue. Many police departments are not responding to firework complaints. regarding the current law. All neighboring states allow sales of fireworks to many Minnesota residents, which we are one of 21 states that prohibits aerial fireworks. This bill finally addresses that imbalance. By legalizing and regulating these products here at home, Minnesota gains revenue that currently leaves the state, better oversight of what is being sold, improving education and compliance, and direct funding for fire departments and safety programs. House File 3547 is not about expanding risk. It's about managing reality responsibly. Minnesotans deserve a system that is transparent, enforceable, and beneficial to our communities. This bill accomplishes that. It supports small businesses, strengthens fire service fundings, and keeps Minnesota competitive with our neighboring states. Fireworks are not dangerous compared to other recreational activities that are legal currently in this state. Fireworks represent one of the lowest incident categories tracked by Minnesota agencies, far below alcohol-related crashes, ATV and UTV incidents, and those resources are coming from Minnesota DNR, Minnesota State Fire Marshal, and the Department of Public Safety. It's also America's 250th birthday, and what a way to celebrate our great nation by finally legalizing aerial and audible fireworks. I'm genuinely excited to become a Minnesota small business owner and to serve my community with pride, responsibility, and transparency. For those reasons, I respectfully ask you to advance House File 3547. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for your time.
Thank you. Next testifier will be Andrew Salma, Edina Fire Chief in the Minnesota Fire Association Coalition. Please identify yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Devotny, Chair Moeller, and committee members for allowing me to testify today. My name is Andrew Slama. I'm the Fire Chief for the City of Edina. And today I'm representing the Minnesota Fire Association Coalition. That is a group comprised of the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association, the Minnesota Fire Department Association, the Fire Marshals Association of Minnesota, and the Minnesota chapter of the International Association of Arson Investigators. I'd like to share our continued opposition of the expansion of legal fireworks in Minnesota and House File 3547. As public safety advocates, we strongly opposed any expansion of legal fireworks in Minnesota. As we know, they will undeniably increase the risk of fires and injuries. The argument that people are using fireworks anyway, so we should at least benefit from the sales tax, fails to acknowledge that broadening the legalization of explosives will absolutely increase their use. With fire departments across the state already struggling to remain fully staffed, we cannot take on what would inevitably be additional calls for fires and injuries caused by these explosives. Any additional tax revenue from these sales would not make up for additional hospital costs and the additional burden on our fire departments. We acknowledge the efforts of Representative Swedzinski and the impact this bill would have on the Volunteer Firefighters Fire Assistance Grant Fund, as well as the fire safety account, but we do not believe that the monetary benefit outweighs the public safety concern and injuries that will certainly exist. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for your time today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Salma. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on this matter? Any questions for Representative Swedzinski or his testifiers at this time? We will have later time. All right. Now, we do have a couple of amendments. Chair Swedzinski and I talked about he will not be offering A2 at this time. I have the A3 amendment, and I move it before the committee. The A3 amendment also updates the effective dates of the bill and reflects changes the section of law made last year. In addition, the A3 amendment creates a new statewide public safety radio communication system equipment grant special revenue account. Tax revenue received from the sale of aerial fireworks are deposited into this special revenue account. The Commissioner of Public Safety is authorized to use the money from the account to award grants to local, tribal, and state agencies to purchase or upgrade armor radio systems. Members, we have been looking for a stable, non-general fund source of revenue for this purpose for years. The 2023 Public Safety Omnibus appropriated $1 million each year to provide grants to local governments for armor radio replacements. We tried to extend the appropriation to the continue giving these grants to local governments in last year's Public Safety Omnibus, but we're unable to do so. Dedicating a sales tax revenue from these aerial fireworks will allow for a stable, ongoing funding source for local governments to replace and upgrade their critical communication equipment that is unable to do using 911 fees. I would appreciate the bill's author's support and the committee's report for this amendment. Representative Pazinski, how do you feel about my amendment?
I think it's a wonderful amendment, Chair Novotny. I think what it really does is give truly a bang for the buck solution to this bill. And, you know, I feel like this has been a conversation. I've talked to my sheriffs and county folks around my district, and they are looking for a solid foundation to build a radio system funding mechanism. And I think this does actually do a really good job of that. And so I appreciate you moving the amendment, and I appreciate
Thank you. This. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. Just a question. Do we have any idea of what the amount of revenue we could be looking at?
Representative Pazinski.
I think House Fiscal Staff is here, but I believe a fiscal note, but I'm not sure if that's been completed or it's in.
Mr. Walsh.
Mr. Chair, members, a fiscal note and revenue estimate had been requested. There was some difficulty with the original language of one of the earlier drafts that the Department of Revenue wanted corrected, and so that's been corrected, and the revenue estimate is a little bit behind schedule, so we don't currently know how much revenue will be generated by this proposal.
Chair Novotny.
Representative Curran.
Yeah. Go ahead. In past, when this bill has been brought before, I think it's been in that $3 to $6 million range. But you know, just from a rough estimate, but it could. My guess is it will fall someplace within that that range.
Fair enough. Thank you,
Representatives Rapinski.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to say, as a former firefighter and the representative of district that is literally right across the river from Wisconsin. I do see the ease of availability to obtain fireworks, the use in our community. I will be supporting this bill. Thank you for bringing it forth. And Chair, can I also add that I'm going to dub this the Freedom Act, which would be fireworks rights encouraging enjoyable displays over Minnesota.
But in poem. Chair Mueller.
We're on the A3, right?
What's that?
On the A3. Okay.
On the A3.
To the A3. I am going to support the A3, but I will just note that we had a bill that we introduced last year, House File 3230, that would provide for a service fee on cell lines at 50 cents a month. It would bring in about $36 million in revenue. So I think we both agree with the need to fund upgrades to armor. I really prefer that approach as opposed to this approach for fireworks, however, willing to accept the amendment for now. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. This, for me, the amendment is it's a voluntary tax that people don't have to pay, and it won't unduly affect anyone that doesn't want to pay it. I will tell you that as a private pilot, I have flown on the 3rd of July and the 5th of July, never on the 4th because the weather has never lined up for me. But I can tell you, especially if one of those dates is on a weekend, the state of Minnesota did not get the memo that aerial fireworks are not allowed. Flying out of Princeton, I can see from about 1,000 feet, I can see up to Mille Lacs Lake when I take off to the north. The people of Mille Lacs Lake did not get the memo. If I turn to the south and look to, I can see into Minneapolis, and it is a solid sea of fireworks. Now, I understand the fire department's concerns, but that is something that is, I'll leave that for the bill. I believe that this funding is important because as I'm flying around on a night near the 4th of July, I count this burst in the sky and I think that is money that has gone to a different state. That is money that could have stayed here and it could have been put to something that we really need. And even though the fire departments oppose my funding thing, they'll still get a cut of it and they'll be beneficiaries. And with that, I ask for your support for the A3 amendment. All in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? And the A3 amendment carries. Questions on the bill as it stands, amended. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. I do have some concerns more than questions, and if there's ways, maybe as I ramble through this, you can answer them. Just expanding a little bit on what Chief Slama said, he didn't quite describe some of the things that firefighters go to. I've been a professional firefighter for 24 plus years. Often when we get called, it's when things have gone bad. Usually there's a mix of alcohol, explosives, and often kids in that realm. I've spent time sifting through yards looking for fingers that people have blown off. I've gone to calls where they've blown up in people's faces and ruptured eardrums, damaged eyes, head injuries. Often to the fire piece, like they're used outside, they're used kind of indiscriminately. We don't know where they land. The number of wildland fires that start with them, it's a bigger issue that we're going to see here in the future. So just from that perspective, like that is the reality of what these things do. And that concerns me to just open it up. I guess I'm generally not one of the, because the law is not enforced, we should just remove it way of thinking. But one thing that we haven't talked yet either is the impact of veterans. There's a ton of studies out there on the irony of the celebration of freedom, if you will, and the impacts it has on those veterans with post-traumatic stress that when they hear those explosions, when they're not expecting them, what that does to them. And, you know, quite often, you know, I work with a lot of veterans from the fire department. My dad's a veteran. They go to places to try and escape that. They leave their homes. They go somewhere else to be more isolated during the 4th of July and those times around it. My concern, one of my big concerns with this too, is it opens up that window. I mean, right now, to the chair's point, I live in a relatively rural part of Duluth, if you will, and the weeks leading up to and following, there's fireworks almost every single night that I can hear and see and everything else. I think that if we open it up, it's going to be more prevalent and cause more of those issues. So those are some of my biggest concerns. I appreciate the creativity with the night, how we fund the radio system. But I would hope that we had looked somewhere else to find that funding. So those are just my comments based on my personal experience and thoughts on the bill. So thank you.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering when I don't know if this is a question for the bill author, when the original statute went into place that restricts fireworks, does anybody know?
Right. Mr. Chair, I did spend 5 seconds just before when I got up here to look at that, and it's probably loaded, but I wasn't able to find when that statute actually came into place. That would be probably a good question for nonpartisan or John Hallquist, who's quite experienced here at the House.
Phoning Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I live in Lake Country, and I have a resort, and on the 3rd, 4th, and 5th of July, like the chair was saying, it's lit up. It's they're there. In Bemidji or Pennington, where I live, it's a very short drive to the Red Lake Indian Reservation. And they have a full supply up there that you can purchase. And it's already there. So it's, you know, I want to see this bill, Representative Swierczynski. I appreciate you bringing it through. And I would like to see a roll call on this bill, please.
Representative Bliss has asked for a roll call. Representative Hollidge, you still had the floor.
Okay, thank you. A little confused there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry.
You owe me now. Okay, I was just wondering because I was hearing folks say that since this has been in place, we haven't actually seen a reduction in harm and nobody's actually using fewer fireworks. And I just was wondering if there was actual statistics on that. I'm sure we can all find examples from within our lived experience where there are fireworks that are being blown up at the wrong times and you know, the ones that we are not legal here. I was just wondering, like, statistically if that was true. But that is probably too complex of a question, and I wouldn't expect you to know the answer to that, especially because Representative Rapinski is over here telling me it was in place since 1941?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we don't have the data on that. So my other comments are, I don't think I can support this bill, and it really occurs to me, having just sat through Tax Committee where we talked about how HCMC is like on the brink of closing, and they have the burn trauma center that is renowned in the entire state, and that people from all over Minnesota are sent to HCMC for burns. And now we're talking about legalizing something that would ostensibly create easier access to more people getting burned while simultaneously our trauma centers are being closed. And I know it's a problem around rural hospitals as well. And so I really see this as, you know, I know in the legislature we tend to think in silos, and I won't go on and on about the tax implications at all, but I do think that when we're looking at this, we're setting ourselves up for a disaster situation, right, where more people have access to more dangerous explosives while simultaneously our healthcare facilities are closing at a rapid rate. And I would hate to think of how long it would take to find, you know, to, I don't know, send somebody to somewhere in Wisconsin or Chicago if they really needed skin grafts and things like that. So for those reasons, I really think we need to be careful about how we think about bills like this, because there are ramifications beyond just having fun. And I especially think, I mean, no offense to you, Mr. Chair, but the change in the where those proceeds are going also disturbs me, because the people who have to deal with the ramifications of newer, bigger explosives being more easily accessible, now those folks aren't getting money. There's not money going to firefighters specifically who get called onto duty. I mean, I don't think that Representative Johnson talked about this, but he told us about searching yards for body parts, right? Like, that's a reality that our firefighters have to go through when people play with these incredibly dangerous explosives. And so I am going to have to be a no on this. Sorry if I'm a killjoy, but, you know, happy 250th birthday to America. Sparklers are great.
Representative Hollins, duly noted as a killjoy. Mr. Johnson has the answer to your question on when it was enacted.
Mr. Chair, members, I think it sounds like Representative Rapinski did my job already, but the ban was put in state law in 1941.
Representative Ingen.
No.
Out. All right. Anyone else? Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think I could express it any better than my colleagues did. And for the reasons they stated, I'm going to be a no vote. Thank you.
Representative Rapinski, Swazinski, I really want to thank you for bringing this forward. As I'm sitting here listening to the other representatives talk about one of the things they bring up, Representative Hollins, I can think of three cases where I sent a burn victim to HCMC. Each one of those involved heavy amounts of alcohol. And that also addresses Representative Johnson's question or statement about alcohol. And unless you want to have a bill to take away alcohol, I think that plays a bigger part in a lot of these things than anything else. And then to answer your question, since it's fact night here in the Public Safety Committee, the skin grafts come from cadavers. And those are mostly harvested at Ramsey County Medical Center. Representative Johnson, you were not here when the marijuana bill came through, and every argument that you made and almost all the other arguments that were made on this about fireworks could be made about marijuana. The fact that since everybody's doing it, we shouldn't allow everyone to do it, and I just find it ironic. With a late question, I'll wrap up. Representative Rapinski.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to make one comment that when voting no for this, I wonder if those people have used fireworks or families use fireworks, aerial stuff, or if they plan on using fireworks again in this holiday. So I would wish that when you make this vote, you consider the fact that if you're going out and buying fireworks and you yourself are lighting bottle rockets and stuff off, that you're saying it's okay for you, but it's not okay for the rest of Minnesotan to do that. So thank you.
Representative Rapinski was looking at me when he said that question. I will plead the fifth. Representative Swazinski, to your bill.
Thank you. And are we still on the amendment?
No. No, we are at passage, sir.
All right, sounds good. No, I appreciate the committee's time. Appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. I think this really is a good conversation for us to have here at the legislature. You know, it was brought up that alcohol has normally been involved with some of the accidents. I represent Granite Falls, which is where Congressman Volstead, the Volstead Act, did ban alcohol. It didn't work out so great. And ultimately, people made the choice and people made the decisions when it came to alcohol and its ban, when it came to bootlegging and the rest. And essentially, while we're not in our bathtubs making fireworks, we are going for drives and buying them and bringing them to the state. And I think, you know, as we have this conversation and as we wrap up session in the next month or two, it would be my hope that we could at least consider some negotiations, maybe look at a way we could narrow this in ways that might be beneficial to different areas of the state and the amount of population density that could be affected with sales, but also, you know, where the building, if the buildings are going to be used, solid buildings or tents, oftentimes the sales of these are to raise money. So if they use temporary tents to sell fireworks and help organizations raise money beyond this, so it's not just a sales tax, but it's also used by organizations to raise money on behalf of their organizations within their communities. And so, you know, we have some great opportunities here to grow business, as my testifier talked to, and grow businesses and create jobs, and just base those here. So sales tax are paid. Jobs are created just across the border. And so with that, I would appreciate a green vote. And you can use just one finger if that's all you've got to vote.
I renew my motion that House File 3547, as amended, is re-referred to the Elections, Finance, and Government Operations Committee. A roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll.
Novotny.
Yes.
Moeller.
No.
Whitty.
Yes.
Feist.
No.
Berg.
No.
Bliss.
Yes.
Curran.
No.
Duren.
Yes.
Engen.
Yes.
Greenman.
No.
Harder.
Yes.
Hollins.
No.
Hudson.
Yes.
Johnson.
No.
Pinto.
No.
Ream.
No.
Rapinski.
Yes.
Schwartz.
Yes.
Steer. Tabke.
With 9 ayes and 9 nays, the motion does not prevail. Thank you, Representatives Swazinski, and to your testifiers. The next bill on the agenda is House File 3651. Representative Harder, please come to the table with your testifiers. Representative Harder moves that House File 3651 come before the committee with a recommendation that the bill is re-referred to Agriculture, Finance, and Policy Committee. Representative Harder, please begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Novotny, and members for hearing this bill today. This bill addresses a narrow equipment compatibility issue that prevents fuel retailers across the state from offering E15 to their customers. The problem is that many stations have dispensing equipment that is perfectly safe for E15 but doesn't meet the documentation requirements in the fire code, which currently requires dispensing equipment to have a UL, or also known as an underwriter's laboratories, listing for the specific blend dispensed. This bill would allow a station to meet the safety standard through a combination of UL certification for E10 and written manufacturer certification for E15. It doesn't lower any safety standards. It creates the second pathway to compliance that reflects science in real-world track records. I have with me today Joe Selward, representing the Minnesota Ethanol Producers Association, to provide testimony.
Please identify yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joe Selwood, and I'm representing the Minnesota Ethanol Producers Association in support of House File 3651. Federal EPA regulations allow fuel dispensing site owners to demonstrate E15 equipment compatibility through either a UL listing or written manufacturer statement. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency rules for underground storage tanks follow the same approach. However, the fire code requires a blend-specific UL listing for above-ground dispensing equipment. House File 3651 would bring compliance with the fire code in line with federal regulations and MPCA rules. Under the fire code, the components of a fuel dispensing system must carry a UL listing specific to the blend being dispensed. The evidence that E10 listed equipment can safely dispense E15 is well established. UL supports the use of E10 listed dispensers for E15 because E10 dispensers were tested using E15 as their aggressive test fuel. Both major manufacturers have warrantied their dispensers for E15. And Iowa has allowed E10 equipment to dispense E15 since 2010. That's 16 years with no safety incidents. House File 3651 would add a pathway to compliance by allowing dispensing equipment to meet the safety standard with a combination of a UL listing for E10 and a manufacturer certification for E15. This brings Minnesota in line with federal standards, MPCA rules, and neighboring states, and it allows more stations to offer E15. Additionally, we appreciate Representative Harder's leadership on this issue and the state fire marshal's engagement, and we look forward to continuing these conversations as we work toward a solution. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Smallwood, or Selwood. Members, questions for the representative or the testifier? Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Just in trying to learn a little bit more about this bill, I did reach out to the fire marshal and had a quick conversation with them today about it. It sounds like they are working on some solutions that may not require legislative action. I share some of the same concerns with in some other committees too, where code changes get brought to us when there is a process to change codes and do that sort of thing, and people come to us to bypass that process. And I don't know if that's a habit that we want to get into unless we really need to. So I guess my question would be probably for Mr. Selwood, with that process that's in place, how come this wasn't brought during that normal review process and reviewed and gone through then?
Mr. Selwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson. That's a good question. I think that when the initial part of that technical advisory group gets together and gets the input of public and folks can bring ideas to a group like that, I think that a little bit that ship had already sailed when we kind of fully identified the problem and what the fix was.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. And we're sending this to the A committee, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Would we be open to having that come back to this committee then, just to work through those code issues and allow the fire marshals an opportunity to try and resolve this, and maybe we don't have to push it through, but have it stop back in here before it goes anywhere?
Representative Johnson, the fire marshal is here, I believe. Where is he? There he is. Would you like to ask him the question now? I remind you that this is the last week. Next week will be the last week for policy. I don't know if it'll get back.
Okay. Yeah, that was my concern is just to give them enough time to work it out, and then if we're the correct group to talk about the code changes, if that needs to happen, it seems like it should come back here with whatever agreement they do get.
Fire Marshal, if you could identify yourself, and if do you have an answer to the question from Representative Johnson?
Yes, Dan Cryer, State Fire Marshal. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson. We are actively exploring what alternatives there are outside of legislative options to see if this can be accomplished outside of the legislature. I don't know that it has to come back here for that to happen. That's a decision for you, this group, to make. But we're actively working on it and could have some resolution on that by the end of this week or early next week.
Representative Johnson.
I thank you, Chair, Fire Marshal. That's my concern, is just to make sure that if there are changes that do have to be made in the code, that if we're the body that is doing that, understanding why you guys weren't able to come to an agreement or what that looks like, so we actually know what the outcomes of those are, as opposed to passing it out first and hoping that they work it out, and then just assuming that we pass it out and they're going to be able to do that, versus having it come back to this committee once, if that is worked out, then we don't have to. If it's not, I think it's something that this committee should at least talk about.
As I said, I don't know if we've got time with the schedule to have it come back here. Would you be comfortable working with Representative Harder before it gets to agriculture to make sure that the concerns that fire marshals have is satisfied?
Sure.
Thank you. Any other questions for the testifiers or Representative Harder? Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I think that your solution that you just proposed is a good one. We'll pass it out, and then as long as Representative Johnson can be in the mix as this bill continues to work its way as we're approaching deadline, I think that's a great solution. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Harder, closing comments.
Thank you, Chair Novotny and committee, for hearing this important bill today for E15. I look forward to working with you, Mr. Johnson, between now and the Ag Committee. And thank you again.
Chair, Representative Harder renews her motion. House File 3651 is recommended to be re-referred to the Agriculture, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion carries, and House File 3651 is re-referred to Agriculture. Next bill on the agenda is House File 4043. Vice Chair Woody, please go to the testifier table with your testifiers. Vice Chair Woody, would you like to move House File 4043 for the committee with a recommendation that the bill is re-referred to the General Register?
That's my wish. Thank you, Chair.
Vice Chair Woody, begin your testimony.
This bill, House File 4043, is a bill that clarifies the specific powers and duties of law enforcement. It's a bipartisan bill with authors on it. And in light of, you know, when the public asks for the police to show up, they want to make sure they've been trained and are doing their jobs and they've been qualified to do the duties that are called upon them. So this bill was brought to me by law enforcement to try to improve service. And I'll turn it over to my testifier for further info.
Please identify yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Jim Michaels. I'm a labor attorney here in Minnesota. I represent a number of police and fire unions. I'm here today to speak in support of House File 4043. As you all know, for decades, Minnesota has maintained among the highest standards in the nation for its peace officers. And these standards include the requirement that our officers have a post-high school degree, that they pass criminal, physical, and mental health backgrounds, that they have proficiency in certain specified skills, they pass a licensure exam, and they have a rigorous and mandatory training requirements that they have to meet in order to retain their license. We also hold them to a level of scrutiny which very few public employees are subjected. We do all these things for a very good reason, and that's because we entrust our peace officers both with the responsibility to keep us safe, but also because we give them the authority to restrict the freedom and liberties of people who have committed or are accused of committing crimes. And we expect our officers to interact with those individuals in ways that protect their constitutional rights. Over the last 5 or 6 years throughout Minnesota and across the nation, we've seen a dramatic shortage of men and women who want to become or remain peace officers. And whether because of this shortage or by the desire of some folks to civilianize more roles within law enforcement, there has been a blurring of the lines between what is done by licensed peace officers and unlicensed civilians. The current statute, 626.83, actually only addresses three functions that must be exclusively performed by a licensed peace officer. And those are issue a citation in lieu of arrest, ask a person to promise to appear in court, and take a person into custody. However, there are far more other extensive types of law enforcement actions that are the subject of the types of training officers receive. But due to the factors I've mentioned, many of these are now starting to be performed by civilians in some agencies. These civilians are not subject to the rigors to ensure their ethical, physical, and mental fitness for duty, nor are they subjected to the ongoing training requirements as licensed officers. The existing statute needs to be updated to more adequately specify those types of law enforcement activities that must be performed exclusively by a licensed and trained peace officer. These functions include preparing and seeking court approval for an arrest or search warrant, presenting a case to a prosecutor to initiate criminal charges, accepting primary responsibility for the investigation of crimes, interviewing criminal suspects, conducting a lineup, operating a squad car with licensed sirens. Many people whom I have discussed this proposed legislation with are really shocked to find that these functions are not already protected in law to be exclusive to peace officers. And I suspect many of your constituents would feel the same way. House File 4043 is just a common sense measure to advance the interests of public safety. Clearly, civilians have a role in police departments, and that role should be to assist licensed peace officers, especially while we face shortages in licensed personnel. However, there is a big difference between assisting and doing police work. Unlicensed, untrained civilians should not replace officers, especially in those functions that can deprive an individual of their liberty or limit their constitutional rights. It is important to our safety that the role and authority of peace officers be more specified in law, and based on that, I would hope that you would support and enact House File 4043. Thank you so much for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that wishes to speak on this bill? Members, questions? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Witte, thank you for bringing this forward. We definitely want to be certain. We know that peace officers have a really solemn responsibility, and we want to make sure that we're clear about when that responsibility is being exercised or not. I guess I'm still struggling a little bit, having heard the testimony about the need for this, and especially how broadly it's written. I guess maybe one thing I'll start with is just the final couple items in the bill seem like they're already covered under the current law prohibiting impersonation of a peace officer, 609.4751. Can you or your testifier just help me understand what we get out of adding those clauses that we don't already have under current law? So we certainly don't want somebody to be impersonating a peace officer.
Vice Chair Whitty?
Yeah, I'm going to turn it over to testifier, but one of the pieces is, and he can back me up on it more, they work in the police department. They're doing some of the duties because of shortage of officers, and it's a way that police departments might have found a way to get some of the tasks done, and it's just maybe gone a little too far. And when you become a police officer, you have to have your license, and you've gone through all the programs. And so I can let my testifier explain a little bit more.
Mr. Michaels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative. Looking at 626.863, which is the unauthorized practice statute, it talks about a violation if somebody performs or attempts to perform an act, duty, or responsibility reserved by law for licensed peace officers. That's the part that's vague that 4043 would attempt to address. So I think that there's certainly a connection between those two statutes, but it is because the unauthorized practice statute is vague in its application. It's really kind of toothless unless there is something in law that specifies what types of activities are exclusive to licensed peace officers.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the testifier. Thank you, Vice Chair Whitty. I guess it's funny, I actually wasn't even looking at 626.863, just farther down in the bill. I was talking about 609.4751, which is it's a crime to impersonate a peace officer with intent to mislead another into believing the impersonator is actually an officer. And I guess I was just, the particular clauses in the bill that I was noticing were, you know, operating a law enforcement emergency vehicle while emergency lights or sirens are activated. So, you know, driving around a squad car with the sirens going, hard to think you're doing that without, you know, you're wanting people to think that you're a peace officer, right? Or that, or the next clause, wearing the uniform or badge of a peace officer, something I think is especially acute for many of us in our minds. But it seems like those clauses would be covered under the current crime of falsely impersonating a peace officer. I'm just struggling to think what new are we getting from those clauses.
Well, I could, Representative Pinto, there's a lot of civilian employees that could be driving a vehicle and could be doing tasks, CSOs, reserves, things like that, that would have legitimate access to these vehicles, but operating them with the emergency lights would be prohibited. Vice Chair Whitty?
Yeah, that's what I was gonna go off of, and might be asked to do a certain task if they're short. And so they do work for the police department. They're not like out in the general public. And so I think they're just, the intention of the bill is to make it that it's defining the law enforcement officer's authority in the roles that they play.
Huh. Representative Pinto. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're talking then about a civilian employee who's driving a squad car with lights and sirens activated and wearing a police uniform, but somebody who is not making other people think that they're a peace officer. They wouldn't be subject to that. I guess I'm trying to get my head around that a little bit, if you understand what's confusing me. Because if you're driving around wearing a police uniform and you're driving a squad car with the sirens and lights on, whether or not you're a police department employee, it kind of seems like you're trying to make people think you're a police officer. So it seems like you'd be in violation. But I guess that confuses me. And then also just the sheer breadth of the language in the bill. I mean, I'm looking at line 1.20, clause 8, interview a person suspected of having been engaged in criminal conduct. I don't see any limitation on that at all. So, I mean, criminal defense attorneys interviewing suspects, the media interviewing someone suspected of criminal conduct. I don't know how. I'm assuming, Vice Chair Whitty, that you intended that to be interviewing them to prove that they committed a crime. I don't see a restriction there. And I'm also thinking about all the civil investigations that happen, whether it's the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit in the Attorney General's office, child protection investigations. There's a lot of investigations that happen that let me ask this, are you trying to prohibit all those kinds of interviews, both investigative interviews and non-investigative interviews of any kind? The only person ever talked to somebody who's suspected of a crime would be a peace officer? Like, how do we think about that?
Mr. Michaels.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. No, that is not the intention, to try and prohibit civilians from engaging in any type of investigative work. There are a lot of civilians that work, for example, in both public defender and prosecutorial offices that would do this type of thing. And if there's maybe amendments to the language of the bill to try and address those concerns, we can certainly work on that. The overarching concern here is to make sure that there are certain functions that for years have been performed exclusively by peace officers, and that they continue to be that. And I think to address some of the other concerns that you've mentioned, the other statutes, both in 609 in the criminal code, but also here in 626, they are vague. And having some specificity about what types of activities are exclusive to licensed peace officers will help everyone.
Mr. Chair, maybe I'll end with this. Thank you, Chair Navani.
Chair Pinto.
Oh, thank you, sir. So maybe I'll just end with this. I understand that general interest. I'll make a comment, but end with a question for you to provide the answer if you can. Like, is there a specific situation you can identify, something where something happened, someone acted in? I'm looking at clause 12 that a law enforcement agency had certain policies that said this has to be done by a law enforcement officer. It was done by somebody else, a problem resulted. Like, I just wonder if you can be specific, because the way this is drafted right now, it's so broad. I can think of sort of holes in almost every one of these clauses. And I respect what you're saying, that they work on the language, but then fundamentally, is there in fact a problem to be solved here? And I'd love to know if there's something specific you can point to, because otherwise, we really have now at least three different statutes that are directed pretty firmly about what peace officers can do and what they can't. And in my experience anyway, they're working pretty well. But we'd love to see if you could identify some kind of specific incident or incidents, ideally, that we could point to. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair.
Vice Chair Lee?
I don't have any examples that were given to me. But what I will say is there are, with the shortages, there are non-post license employees performing traditional license duties. So they do work for the police department. They might wear a different colored shirt than the officer, but when they're in that capacity, someone might assume that they are law enforcement. That's where I'm assuming this was brought to me, and where I see it being, trying to identify that these roles need to be by licensed police officers that have taken the post exam and have been sworn in to serve their communities.
Nothing further, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And to the question about, you brought up some of these interviews that could be done by investigators. As you're aware, I went to your training about the forensic investigators and that could be involved in a child abuse situation. That's an investigation of a criminal activity, but it's not a person suspected. It's a victim.
Right. Maybe, Mr. Chair, I guess, as long as you had that comment back, I'll just note, I don't know what you could point to that would limit that clause at all. A person suspected of having been engaged in a criminal activity includes somebody who's committed child abuse or committed public program fraud or heck, when the media interviews somebody. There's no constraints on line 1.20 at all that I see. Anyway, thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Other questions? Chair Mueller.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly do understand the underlying intent of the bill. I do share Chair Pinto's concerns about the breadth of how this is written. I mean, I'm thinking about even clause number 4, drafting a search warrant. Right. Sometimes prosecutors help with the drafting of those search warrants. The investigators, like the Medicaid Fraud Unit at the Attorney General's office, has investigators. And then particularly clause 8 that was mentioned before, maltreatment interviews, defense attorneys doing the interviews, employers sometimes are interviewing employees who have been suspected of engaging in criminal conduct, and even schools have that. So I think it's just too broad as written. I am curious to know if you've reached out to stakeholders, I would imagine, like the chiefs and the sheriffs. I'm just curious if you've reached out to them and sought their feedback on this.
Vice Chair Woody.
Yeah, thank you. I have heard from the chiefs and the sheriffs. I think they're neutral on it. There's some concerns that they probably would want to see more into the bill. So, but this was brought to me from the law enforcement unions.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I certainly hope more work can be done on narrowing the language a little bit to achieve what it is that you're trying to accomplish. Again, certainly understand the goal, but can't support it in the form it's in today.
Thank you. Vice Chair Woody, would you like to change your motion for the bill to be laid over?
That'd be great, Chair Novotny.
With that, House File 4, would you like to close?
No, thank you for the discussion. I appreciate it. That's the way that we hopefully make things better and have these discussions, and I appreciate it, so thank you.
With that, House File 4043 is laid over. Vice Chair, the next bill on the agenda is House File 4282. Vice Chair Whitty, you can stay at the table. This bill is also yours. Vice Chair Whitty moves House File 4282 before the committee, and since the fiscal note came back with zero cost to the state, Vice Chair Whitty reflects that the bill is re-referred to the General Register. Vice Chair Whitty, begin your testimony, please.
Thank you. House File 4282, this bill, last year we passed the bill for the jail medication that I think had a huge impact, and when we voted it out of here bipartisanly. What this bill looks to do is change after it's been implemented. There might be some unintended consequences, and so hopefully to change some of the jail medication requirements that might help strengthen this bill. So I'll leave it to my testifiers who have more on it and live it every day. Thank you.
First testifier, state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Chair Novotny, Chair Mueller, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Dan Guida, and I serve as the elected sheriff of Aiken County. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Sheriffs Association, which represents all 87 sheriffs in Minnesota. Minnesota Sheriffs Association did not support the 2025 changes to Minnesota Statute 241.021 Subdivision 4F governing jail medication practices. The MSA actually joined a lawsuit challenging the law. As written, the statute effectively requires jail medical providers to continue any claimed prescription medication, even when a physician determines that doing so is medically inappropriate, harmful, or potentially fatal. MSS 241.021 does provide exceptions, but they often cannot be met in a timely or realistic manner. It undermines professional medical judgment, increases the risk to inmate health, and imposes unnecessary costs on all counties. Since its passing, this law has also contributed to medical providers withdrawing from contracts, creating interruptions, and ultimately reducing access to quality medical care in our Minnesota jail facilities. Changes are needed to this law. Instead of promoting accurate and current medical care for inmates, MSS 241.021 needlessly creates risk by requiring the continuation of prescriptions for inmates, including the inmates who do not make healthy life choices prior to their incarceration. Occasionally, the prescriptions are current and appropriate, and in that scenario, they are maintained without any interruptions. More often, they are not and have not been followed for some time. This law unduly interferes with our jail medical providers' ability to provide accurate medical diagnoses. I have some points I'd like you to carefully consider. Once people are in custody, their medical and mental health care becomes a legal responsibility of the counties and our medical providers. Minnesota jails typically contract with medical providers who often specialize in correctional health care. These providers, like community providers, have the ability to address rapidly changing health needs. But unlike community providers, jail medical providers are not paid on the basis of medications that they do or do not prescribe. Last year, Minnesotans disposed of 8,580 pounds of medications. That's a lot of pills in the take-it-to-the-box locations. I have one of these in my office, and we dispose of over 350 pounds of these medications every year. Think of 70 boxes like this full of pills. These medications are disposed by residents because medical scenario changes or prescription changes or all those things. They're leftover meds that were at one time prescribed and no longer needed or wanted because of some change. MSS 241.021 restricts the ability to address the exact same changes for people incarcerated. Continuing to provide the same prescriptions at the same dosage risks inmate health. In jails, with the absence of street drugs and alcohol, a totally altered diet combined with lifestyle changes can make continuing some medications very harmful inmates. MSS 241.021 mandates that medical providers choose between following the statute, which could violate their medical oaths and open themselves up to malpractice, or violate the statute, which places jails at risk of license sanctions. Prescriptions appropriate in the community are also often inappropriate in a controlled environment in the jail. The current statute also mandates prescriptions that may be unneeded due to jail environments. Think about Viagra, marijuana, narcotics, sleeping pills, gabapentin medications, and many others. Not applicable in jail, and there's other medications that can certainly follow those things, like pain medication. We can get people pain medication without following a narcotic pain medication that couldn't be handled in a jail because it would be causing to put those inmates in dangerous situations where the other inmates could be involved with them. The option to obtain outside provider approval in the statute is often not realistic because of the difficulty in contracting these providers. Minnesota jails operate 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Efforts to consult community providers typically take many days for local residents and may never happen for non-local residents. So the current law's relief valve simply does not work as designed. Obtaining written consent from the incarcerated patient also often will not work because the person may be drunk, high, or in some type of mental health crisis. The incarcerated person may simply elect to be defiant and even resistant when it's contrary to their best interests and health needs. Prior to incarceration, many of our inmates do a thing that we call doctor shopping, and they have multiple prescriptions that taken together is dangerous. Restarting them once in jail without medical review could also be harmful or even fatal. Across the state, several medical providers have already left the field of providing medical care to incarcerated people. One doctor has resigned and another provider canceled the agreement to provide medical care to over 200 beds in rural Minnesota. Another small rural jail has had to almost double its medical staffing to comply with the law since it's been enacted. And again, these were all unintended consequences. In many counties, the unintended consequences of the current laws have actually reduced the available quality medical care for incarcerated persons, not the intent of the law. In Aiken County, we are blessed to have Mary Mapes as our provider. Mary has a lifetime of work in the medical field. She started as a young first responder, advanced to paramedic, and continued schooling while she was working through nurse practitioner to the provider she is today. I have had the pleasure of working with Mary for over 30 years in my law enforcement career, and when Aiken County was dropped by a nationally known correctional healthcare facility or company, I called her for advice. Now I'm proud to say that I believe the care provided in Aiken County Jail is probably the best in the state of Minnesota. At this time, I would like you to hear from Dr. Mapes. Mary.
Please identify yourself and begin your testimony.
Hello, my name is Mary Mapes. I'm a board-certified family nurse practitioner. I work both in the community and for Aiken and actually Cass County's jails. And I kind of want to review how the prescription situation works for the average person. You go to the doctor for a medical concern. That prescriber gives you a medication based off the diagnosis that they feel is wrong, or you know, of what's wrong with you. You get that prescription, you go to pick it up at the pharmacy. Lots of times in the population in the jail that I see, the medication was either never picked up or it was picked up and abused or picked up and not used. So when they still are having the symptoms, they use street drugs and alcohol to medicate their issue rather than the actual prescribed medication. They don't follow up on these medications, and so when they get arrested, they have either not been taking their medication, they have not seen that provider in over several months to a year, or they've only seen that provider one time because they're hopping around or doctor shopping for a specific kind of medication. So when they come to the jail, they are frequently under the influence of other medications where that prescription medication is going to interfere with the drugs that they're currently under. The other issue with that is that the medications generally need to be followed as far as lab results, whether their kidney function's working, their electrolytes are balanced. Many medications affect these things. And if they're brought to the jail and made to maintain all the different prescriptions they've gotten from multiple providers, even if the current prescription is current, you're going to have a bunch of med reactions, interactions with them. An example is a SSRI medication, which is a serotonin reuptake inhibitor medication that's commonly used for depression. If you mix multiples of those together, you get a issue or a problem called serotonin syndrome, which causes them to have rapid heart rates and can ultimately cause them to pass away. Other things are if they have multiple blood pressure medications or things like this, the medication needs to be followed so that we know that their kidneys are working, their liver is working, their electrolytes are okay, and they're not getting too many of the same kind of medications that will drop their heart rate, drop their blood pressure. They come to jail, I have to give them all these medications that were prescribed by multiple people, and the person that comes to me is not the person that went and got that prescription. They're in a different situation. I'm a medical provider in the community as well as in the jail, and I can do an assessment on that person and decide this medication is not appropriate for them, and to have me call an already taxed clinic provider who sees frequently is told you have to see 40 patients per day, you have a 15-minute window to see that patient, and they push them to see as many patients as possible. And then I come to them and the other people that do my job. There's roughly around 69,000 inmates that go in and out of jails in a year in Minnesota. That's 69,000 phone calls that they don't frankly have time to answer, to call me back and say, yes, this medication should be continued. No, this medication shouldn't be continued. Or the other thing I've been told is, I don't know, I saw that person one time a year and a half ago. So they're not up to date with the current status of that patient or inmate. And it's hard for them to see what I'm seeing when they come into the place, so I can more appropriately provide the medical care that they need. And the other thing is the inmate population is very bad at being compliant with their medications. So they come in, they haven't taken their medications for months and months and months, and now I'm going to give them a medication that they haven't had. And there's every medication can cause a direct problem. So when you give medications, you have to be cautious with how you prescribe it, what you're prescribing it for. Are they going to be compliant with it? Now, I can't say that if I gave you a prescription, you're going to go and do what you're supposed to do with it and you're not going to abuse it. I can't make sure that you do that. But in a jail, it's very situationally in a jail it's a lot higher risk if I'm giving them a medication that they should have been taking, haven't been taking, now they've mixed street drugs and stuff on top of it. It makes it very dangerous. And the other issue, you know, if you're concerned that the inmate is a fragile medical patient, I'm all for consulting their special providers that need to address those things, but getting responses from the people that are busy in the real world is hard to get that response, and it's been usually weeks and sometimes never do we get a response from their primary care provider. So basically, if we could move forward with the new 4282, that would also help untie my hands so I can provide the appropriate medical care for that person. I'm a provider just like the person who provided that prescription, and I have a more accurate and current ability to know what's wrong with that person.
Thank you, Doctor. Next testifier is Commissioner Snell. Commissioner Snell, welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Paul Snell. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Corrections. Let me begin by where I believe we're all aligned. The department, the county sheriffs, the legislature share the same goal, to ensure that people in custody receive safe, appropriate, and continuous medical care. That's the purpose of this law, and it is the outcome that we're all accountable for. Just to be clear, the Department of Corrections is neutral on this bill. I'm here today because statements were placed on the record about the department in a letter by MSA General Counsel that are not accurate and frankly inappropriate. When that happens, I believe it's important to correct the record clearly and directly. At the outset, I want to address two areas of fundamental mischaracterization that take shape in this discussion. The letter you received from the Sheriff's Association Council advances an extreme reading of this statute, one that prioritizes consent or consultation over a patient's health. That's a false dichotomy and is not how we read the law. It is not present in the statute, and it's not how the department interprets or implements this law. The letter also suggests that the department would adopt that same interpretation and take enforcement action on licensing against jails operating under real-world medical conditions, and that, too, is incorrect. On the first issue, at a high level, the department's interpretation and implementation of this law is straightforward. Continuity of care is the goal, and clinical judgment remains central. Providers are not required to continue medications that are not medically appropriate, and they are expected to act in the best interest of patient health and safety. That is how we've approached this from the beginning, and that's how we're implementing it in practice. Our approach is straightforward. Patient health and clinical judgment come first. The statute allows providers to act when a medication is not medically appropriate, and our guidance reflects that providers are expected to make good faith efforts to consult on cases, not to delay necessary care. In emergency situations where a patient cannot consent, and there is no time to consult, providers can and should act in the moment to protect the patient's health. There is a clear and meaningful difference between permanently discontinuing a medication and temporary withholding doses while stabilizing a patient. The law does not require providers to compromise care in those situations. I do want to be very clear on my next point because it goes to the integrity of how the law is being discussed. This statute does not require providers to choose between doing what is medically appropriate and complying with the law, and the department would not interpret or enforce it in that way. There should be no doubt, none, that the department would not take enforcement action against the facility or provider because they took necessary or life-saving measures. Suggesting otherwise is not only inaccurate, it's absurd. Finally, I need to raise the manner in which some of these issues have been raised. Referencing ongoing litigation, misrepresenting discussions between attorneys, and presenting internal staff communications as though they represent official department positions are not appropriate contributions to these discussions. Every office or organization represented here has a staff who discuss their thoughts on policies and legislation that do not reflect the agency's official position or the public policy position of the state. Their opinions are theirs and not official policy. This is, and I repeat, this is an important policy conversation. If there are concerns about how the statute is structured and what is required, that is an appropriate conversation for the legislature to consider. The DOC's role in this is clear. Implement the law faithfully with reasonableness, operational clarity, and a focus on safety. And this is exactly what we're doing. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Commissioner Snell. Any other testifiers on this bill? Please identify yourself for the record. Once you get situated and sit down, you'll have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon, chairs and members of the committee. My name is Christine Hill. I am the mother of Larry R. Hill. Larry passed away in 2023 while in custody at Hennepin County Correctional Center. I'm here today because No family should have experienced what my family had experienced. After Larry died, we worked together with the lawmakers, advocate, to pass the Larry R. Hill Medical Reform Bill. The law was created to make sure that people in custody continue receiving their medical and their medication. There was always prescribed by their doctors. If there was meant to be prevented other families from going through the pain that my family lived with. The care of people in jail and the prison is very important to me. I went to school to be a correction officer. I did it for 2 years. When someone in custody, their life is in our hands. They cannot go to the store and get their own medication. They cannot pick up their medication. They cannot advocate for themselves the same way as we could if we're outside. The system was responsible to make sure that they are safe and receive proper medical care. One of the most important safeguards of the current law is making sure that the jail medical staff consists within the person original prescription before making handling to their medication, that the doctors know that the patient needs the medication. It does not matter what it is, as long as it's prescribed by a doctor. The HF4282 removes the important safeguard, allowing medication to be stopped or changed without fully understanding the person's treatment plan. To me, that feels like taking a step backwards. We should never accept a shortcut when it comes to other people's lives or health care. When medications are withheld, changes without proper condition, it can have serious or common deadly consequences. The package of the Larry R. Hill Act was meant to create a safeguard so that people in the custody are treated with care and dignity, and so that the families like mine do not have to live with losing a loved one. If this bill passed, I worry that we are weakening these protections and putting lives at risk. I ask today if you please say no to the HF4282 for the safety of other inmates or anyone in the correction facility. Thank you. Thank you. I'm sorry. No
worries. Thank you. Is there any other testifiers? Member questions? Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you would indulge me, I have quite a few comments this time, more than I would normally have. My first question is this motion to lay the bill over? That was my understanding, because I know there were some thoughts about amending the language.
Yes, it is being laid over.
Okay, thank you. Because the bill as written really guts what we did when we passed this law last year. And I really appreciate that Ms. Hill was here again. She was here last year. I really appreciate that she is here today to testify again to remind us of the reason why we passed this. And it wasn't just for her situation. I was going back and looking through my notes from the last hearing, and there are many other situations where Minnesotans have died in jail in part because they weren't getting the medical care they deserve. So I just want to ground us in that before I move on to my next statement. And Representative Witte, thank you for bringing this bill, and these comments are not directed at you in any way, shape, or form. I had told the Sheriff's Association I still intend to do this. The bill will lay over. As we do, we will continue to work with them on amendments. However, the letter that was submitted for this committee is a misstatement of what happened last year, and I would like to correct the record. So in the letter, it said that the bill passed with almost no detailed vetting of the language that was enacted. They're in litigation right now trying to stay enforcement of the statute, which they've been unsuccessful in doing thus far. And the House, they say, there was a very brief hearing of an earlier version of the bill, not at all like the version that came out of conference committee, was included in the public safety omnibus bill in which this amendment was included. Had there been an opportunity for medical providers, sheriffs, and jail administrators formally present their views and testimony on the bill as finally enacted, I highly doubt this bill would have been enacted in its present form. And I would like to describe exactly what happened last year, because there is litigation, and I don't know if those involved in that litigation are listening to this, and I really think it's important for the record. On March 4th, the DFL offered this bill language from House File 264 as an amendment to House File 327. We spoke to the amendment and withdrew it because there was agreement that the bill would be a standalone bill. On March 20th, the DFL-CA posted a committee hearing agenda for March 25th that included House File 264. The email notice was sent to the committee's listserv. March 24th, the DFL-CA posted the committee materials for 264 to the webpage. Again, an email notice was sent out. March 25th, House File 264 was heard as a standalone bill and placed on the general register on a voice vote. There was no testimony in opposition. There was no written testimony in opposition. We had two testifiers in support, numerous letters of support for this bill. At the March 25th hearing, a member clarified on the record that the provision only applied to county jails and not state-run facilities. Officials connected with MSA could be seen on the screen sitting in the audience during the bill presentation. March 27th, the DFL-CA posted the committee's agenda for April 1st, and that was for the omnibus policy package, was House File 1354, and the list that was posted to be included clearly included House File 264. Again, an email notice went out for the listserv. March 31st, the DFL committee administrator posted the committee materials related to this. April 1st, the House File 1354 was calendared. The amendment that included the language for 264 was added. Again, no written testimony regarding the inclusion of that in the public safety policy package. The bill was placed on the general register on a voice vote. The House Rules Committee calendared the bill on April 24th. On April 25th, the House passed House File 1354 that included this language on a 133-1 vote, which does not happen frequently in this place. Again, no opposition was expressed at that time for this bill. The House, as we do, brought the 1354 to the conference committee. Throughout this entire time, I, as co-chair, never heard any opposition to House File 264 or the inclusion of it in the policy package. On May 10th, our DFL committee administrator proactively reached out to the Sheriff's Association, because in conference committee we were talking about an amendment to 264, and we thought everybody was fine with 264. We never heard anything. We wanted to make sure they were okay with the amended language.
And then that was the first point where we heard that they were opposed to 264 altogether. First time we heard that. I had some back and forth between the Sheriff's Association and the bill's author, phone calls. We talked about specific amendments, ways to amend this language. Both Chair Novotny and I met with the lobbyist in that side room back there. I remember having that conversation to talk about amended language. I know Senator Latz talked to them as well. Again, we didn't hear opposition to what we were dealing with the amendments. And I actually placed on the record on May 14th in conference committee that part of the amendment was brought for two reasons, which included stakeholder involvement. And I said, and then we wanted to make sure that before medication that someone who's incarcerated in a correctional facility comes in and is on, if a change is made to that medication, that the right healthcare professionals are consulted before that change is made. And that's what the amendment does, and that was in consultation with the stakeholder. At this point, again, I had not heard any opposition to the amended language. The House passed that conference committee report on a vote of 131-3. Again, none of us in this room heard opposition, and I'm sure we would have, if there was opposition to it from our sheriffs, we would have heard about it. And then the first time I heard about the lawsuit was on June 19th, 5 days after Melissa Hortman was murdered. And, you know, I am willing to work on amendments now, but the misrepresentation of what happened previously is very, very frustrating. And I thank you for the time to put this on the record.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And I will add that we did spend literally hours working on this with everyone. And Ms. Hill, this is something that we wanted to get right. That is why we spent the time on it, because we wanted to get it right. And I hope that we will continue to do what it needs to get this bill right and make sure that the persons in the custody get the services that they need, and it's still responsible and in a position that the county can provide the services that they need. Chair Witte, closing statement.
I echo what you say. Ms. Hill, thank you for your testimony. Thank you, Chair Mueller. I was hoping that I'd bring peace, figure out where we can work on this, and I'm glad that everyone is open to figuring out if there's anything that needs to be tweaked. Thank you.
And with that, House File 4282 is laid over. The last bill on our agenda is House File 4095. Representative Davis, I see you're here. Please come to the table with your testifiers. Representative Davis, I will move House File 4095 before the committee. The fiscal note came back and shows no cost at the state for this bill, so I will recommend that the bill is re-referred to the General Register. And Representative Davis, you as the author have an author's amendment coded A2. I will move your amendment. Please explain the A2 amendment.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. It's wonderful to be here with you this afternoon. The A2 amendment, it's just basically expanding. We originally had talked about worship services with this bill. I just wanted to expand that to be the free exercise of religion. And so that's what this author's amendment does.
Members, any questions or discussion on the A2 amendment? All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. The motion carries and the amendment is adopted. Representative Davis, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, it's an honor for me to introduce to you House File 4095. It's a bill to protect one of our most fundamental freedoms, the right to worship in peace. In Minnesota, we have a wide diversity of faiths, folks gathering together in synagogues, mosques, temples, churches, and many other sacred places, places where men, women, and children gather to find fellowship and to have a providential connection to something that's greater than themselves. In recent years, we have seen disturbing incidents across our nation, including right here recently in Minnesota, where individuals deliberately enter religious establishments during services, not to join in prayer or reflection, but to shout, protest, intimidate, or otherwise intentionally disrupt the peaceful exercise of religion. And no Minnesotan should have this sacred time interrupted by unwelcome disruptors. House File 4095 addresses a gap in our laws currently. With strong accountability, this bill creates a specific criminal offense for anyone who enters a religious establishment with the intent to interfere with the right of religious freedom and commits a crime. It builds upon existing statutes while making clear that intentional interference with holy gatherings crosses a line that we will not tolerate. This is not about limiting speech or protest outside these spaces. Those rights remain fully protected. It is about ensuring that inside, during worship, the sacredness of the moment is not to be infringed. This is not a partisan issue. We need to protect our religious establishments. We need to protect their congregants. And this is very dear to my heart, being a local pastor in my own local community. I urge my colleagues to support House File 4095. And with that, Mr. Chair, I have a testifier here with me as well.
Hello.
Thank you, Representative Davis. I see you have a testifier with you. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
My name is Gail Holmes. I am a lifelong Minnesotan, and I've been a churchgoer since I was 3 years old, which is over 80 years. I love my God and my Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, and I love my country, the United States of America. My country is a land of freedom. Without laws, we would have disorder, trouble, confusion, and chaos. We need to be a land of law, order, and accountability. The First Amendment of our Constitution says that we have the right to peacefully assemble. We have the freedom of religion and to worship God in the way which we see fit. Lately, I have grown uneasy. I've read about people entering churches during services not to pray, but to shout, block doors, or intimidate folks right in the pews. I should not have to be concerned that my time with God could be disrupted or to feel unsafe. Our founders knew that our First Amendment rights are essential. Thomas Jefferson rightly said that no one shall otherwise suffer on account of his religious opinions or beliefs. This bill is a simple step to honor that promise. It protects peaceful worship inside our houses of faith from deliberate disruption. If that is violated, it brings clear accountability. It lets me know that my government has my back. Please support this bill. Thank you for listening to an old widow who just wants to keep her faith in peace. God bless you all. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Holmes. Any other person want to testify on this bill? Members. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. I understand where this bill is coming from. I think we all do. I just wanted to take a minute to note some of your comments, Representative Davis, about disturbing incidents that have happened in places that we consider sacred, individuals who intentionally disrupt those who are just peacefully exercising a variety of the rights that we have. And I just have to say that in my community, the effects have been that people don't want to show up to school, they don't want to show up to church, they can't show up to work because the government is disturbing all of that activity. And we've had a whole slew of bills that would address those very problems in a lot of sacred spaces where our community members and our children not only deserve to be, but have a right to be. And all of those were just not even talked about in a way that we could come together or should be bipartisan. They were very, very vehemently shot down as political fodder. And I'm not going to do that to your bill. I'm not going to call it political fodder because I do agree that people should not be disturbed in places where they have a right to be. But I don't see this as a solution. I see this as, this is the sort of bill where other people may have problems, other people may experience things, but you know, we distance ourselves from that. It doesn't happen to me. The thing that is important to me, I will bring a bill for, and I will make sure that I am protected, or I will make sure that this one case is protected and ignore the thousands of other things that are happening in the communities around me. That's one of the reasons that I am opposed to this bill. And I would also argue that there are a lot more ways to protect congregates that extend far beyond a single church service. That includes making sure that the families who live in our communities aren't torn apart, that their doors aren't busted down, that their kids aren't deported, that families are fed. And we've had legislators who were outspoken against delivering groceries to families who are suffering. And I really struggle in the context of doing what's right, in the context of doing things because people are moved through such deep convictions in their faith to do the right thing, that the only right thing in this situation is to be left alone when it's time to worship, and then turned a blind eye to everything when they leave. So I'm not going to support this.
I remind the members that the bill we're discussing today is Bill 4095. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. I too have a few concerns with this. I'm not a churchgoer. When I have gone in the past, I generally don't find that same peace that you do, Ms. Holmes. I'm glad that you do, and I know it's important for a lot of folks. So I just want to ask, maybe it'll boil down to a question, but the broadness of this is concerning to me. Let's say I do find myself back in a church, and the pastor says something that I find extremely offensive, and I have an outburst and a scoff or an exclamation of some point. The way this is written, one, how do you prove that I had just that come over me at the moment versus my intent to go into that building and do that? And then with the broadness of disorderly conduct, I mean, in this case, would I be charged with a gross misdemeanor because I disrupted the rest of the service? Would be under this disorderly conduct statute. The broadness of it is very concerning to me as far as intent as well as committing a crime while you're there. So I guess how do you prove that intent?
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, great question, because what you're bringing up here is actually what I've been trying to wrestle through myself while I was preparing for this bill and preparing the amendment. So that is a great question. It's been my same struggle because, another example I'll just bring up, my concern was what if someone stands up and starts prophesying in the middle of a church service or a mosque service or wherever. What I went back to seeing was, their intention is to interfere in the service, and I would argue that you know, if you didn't like something the pastor may have said, I'd probably just encourage that person to get up and walk out. But yeah, what if in the moment they just get angry? Their intention is not to interfere in the worship service. They're just having a struggling moment. And I would think that the congregants with common people got common sense in church or in a mosque or in a synagogue. I think they would understand that, and I certainly think a judge would understand that as well. Even going back to the situation I brought up there, the example I brought up, but I think the focus also goes to, and they commit a crime. So I mean, disorderly conduct is already a crime. It's not a good idea. And what this bill is doing is saying, listen, people are here to exercise their First Amendment right of freedom of religion, and we need to protect that. And that's what this bill is about.
Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson. All right. Members, we do have a long list of people who want to testify. Chair Moeller, was it? Can we go over about five? All right. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so I guess I'm a little confused as to the stated opposition to this. It's a very simple one-page bill with the amendment in line 1-8, disruption of religious service, provided a person who enters a religious establishment with the intent to interfere with the lawful exercise of the right of religious freedom guaranteed under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution and commits a crime within the religious establishment is guilty of a gross misdemeanor. That's pretty specific. I don't know how you could possibly argue that that's broad. The intent to interfere with the lawful exercise of the right of religious freedom and then commits a crime in the process of doing that is guilty of a gross misdemeanor as opposed to a simple disturbing the peace, which is a misdemeanor. I find it, frankly, mind-boggling that our argument against doing this would be that there's a bunch of other things that ought to be done alongside it. This is how we legislate, one bill at a time, one provision at a time. The idea that you're going to not move on this because there's a bunch of other things you'd like to do. What we're talking about today is limited the scope of 4095. It's limited the scope of this issue, and it's either a yes or a no. So with that in mind, I would request a roll call.
Representative Hudson requests a roll call. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Davis, for bringing this bill. Based off of the initial comments from my friends on the other side, I would typically get mad at those initial and onset comments. I'm not going to this time, despite my wanting to. But I do happen to share a community with Representative Curran. I want to make sure I pronounce it right. And having grown up in downtown White Bear Lake, I also heard from residents, actually a neighbor of my parents who reside in downtown White Bear. And this neighbor that I've known since I was a kid running around, tearing up their backyard, playing baseball in it, they're a member of the city's church in St. Paul that was most recently in the news for having a disturbance occur. They had tears in their eyes when they were telling me about how kids were scared in their house of worship, that adults were shouted down and made to feel as if they were the most horrid things that this earth has to offer when they were simply trying to worship. And even my own father-in-law, who's a pastor, he called me and he was very disturbed. He was sad, not just frustrated, he was sad because he felt as if himself and others who he talks with, who are pastors themselves, not only don't know how to navigate that that occurrence or the potential for occurrence, but thought that it would heighten and that it would occur more frequently after that incident, and it has. Tomorrow we're off for Eid break, and what I would hate to see is that this committee votes down the most basic and fundamental of our constitutional rights, the right to free assembly and freedom of religion and worship as we see fit. We vote this thing down based off of the political rhetoric surrounding where it arose from rather than the basic notion and core tenet to which we've all taken an oath to. That's what we're talking about here. Protect people's right to freely worship as they see fit without it becoming a political football. That's really simple, guys. It's really simple, and we should all be able to get behind it. So thank you.
Representative Ream.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Davis, for bringing this bill forward. Gives us an opportunity to talk about intersection of church and legislation. I, too, believe in the right to worship in peace. I believe in sacred time. I believe in, you know, when you're in a church or a synagogue or a mosque, you know, that there is a sacredness of the moment, which is why I was so bothered when the current administration removed those protections for these sensitive places. And now as of January 20th, 2025, the current administration rescinded protected area policies that previously had limited immigration enforcement at sensitive locations. So now ICE and Customs and Border Patrol can now arrest and interview people at school, at a hospital, at their church, synagogue, mosque, at social service sites, and I find that really troubling. I think we should have protected spaces in this country. And what we have seen, at least in my area, and I know I've heard other people talk about this, is there has been a decreased attendance at churches and other places of worship. People are afraid. We have people in my community who are patrolling around churches to make sure that people feel safe in their church when they're worshiping, or they feel safe when they're at their mosque. And so, you know, I don't feel like this bill addresses the moment we're in right now, where people are afraid to go to church. They are afraid to go to the synagogue. They are afraid to go to their mosque and worship freely and practice their First Amendment rights. And finally, I just want to say that there are laws that do protect us in this situation. There's a law under MS 609.28. It's a misdemeanor up to 90 days in jail to intentionally prevent another person from performing any lawful act enjoined upon or recommended to the person by the religion which the person professes. And it is a gross misdemeanor up to 364 days in jail to intentionally and physically obstruct any individual's access to or regress from a religious establishment, which it defines as a building used for worship services by a religious organization and clearly identified by such with a posted sign or other means. There's also a law that we have for disorderly conduct. So I feel like the laws we have right now do protect us, and I will not be supporting this bill. Thank you.
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Davis, for bringing this bill. You know, 6 months ago, dozens of people were hurt, and two children were killed at a shooting at the Annunciation Church. They were gathered there for Mass. These were children excited to be worshiping next to their friends and their favorite teachers. And they were killed, and it was a horrific act of violence. And on this side of this committee table, we brought forward bills. Your two authors are sitting right here. Brought forward bills to try to do something to stop the next time. And we know there's a next time.
Mr. Chair, what bill are we on?
Because
Mr. Chair, what
in 2017, there was a shooting at First Baptist Church.
Representative Byrd, we are on bill 4095, and we are close.
I am aware of that, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm aware of that. So in 2017, shooting at First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, 26 killed, 22 injured. 2018, shooting at Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, 11 killed, 7 injured. 2015, shooting at Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, 9 killed, 1 injured. 2012, shooting at the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin, 7 killed, 3 injured. These are the things that are happening in our sacred spaces, in the places where we worship. And when we brought forward legislation
that would
help on something, sorry, that would actually help tragedies that we've seen and you on your side of the aisle wouldn't even look at the Annunciation families. You're looking at me now. You wouldn't look at the Annunciation families.
Okay. Representative Berg, speak to the bill. We'll move on to Representative Greenman. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And whatever you think about the protest.
Can you pull your mic closer, Representative Greenman?
Thank you. I'm not used to sitting in this very awkward seat. So speaking to the bill 4095, whatever you think about the protest that this bill seems drafted in response to, it cannot and should not be the only way we respond to the federal occupation of Minnesota. And we talked about, you talked about our fundamental rights, the First Amendment. We have seen in the last few months federal agents lawlessly and brutally violate the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment. We all saw it with our own eyes. Minnesotans illegally arrested, detained for peacefully observing, journalists and protesters, bystanders pepper sprayed, tear gassed, two Minnesotans killed by federal agents. And you heard about from my colleagues.
We're on Bill 4095, and we are out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things we are talking about is the constitutional rights and how we need to protect them. We responded to that. The federal government, the ongoing violation of our rights. We heard in this committee, Chair Mohler's bill, House File 3405, requiring the BCA's participation in investigations of office-involved shooting. We heard Representative Holland's bill to prevent local law enforcement from being deputized to assist ICE in 287G contracts. Just yesterday, we heard Representative
Finke's
bill
that
simply requires law enforcement. Mr. Chair, our GOP colleagues have blocked all of these and now are asking us to say that the one way we respond is by...
Thank you, Representative Greenman. Representative, our Chair Mohler, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly wish that our members had more opportunity. I mean, as you can tell, we're very, very frustrated by the things that we have tried to bring forward to address the moment we're in. You know, when we see this bill, I will note, as Representative Ream mentioned, we do have statutes that already deal with this. She cited the other provisions of 609.28. We have disorderly conduct statutes, trespassing statutes, that already really get to, I think, Representative Davis, what you're trying to accomplish here. And so, you know, and I'll speak to two. I have a church in my district that has a Latino mass, and they are substantially down. People can't go to church. So I think if our goal is to protect places that are sacred, we should be looking at a broader picture. Because it seems like your bill is trying to meet the moment with an incident that happened, and we've brought a lot of bills to try to meet the moment as well. And so I think viewing this in isolation is very frustrating to us, and for that reason, can't support it today. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair Mohler. A little over a year ago, the members of this side of the aisle and the legislative staff sat and for 17 or 18 minutes were screamed at with some of the most vile vulgarities that I've experienced in a while, and that did not rise to the level of disorderly conduct in the view of the Ramsey County Attorney's Office or the St. Paul Attorney's Office. So Mr. Johnson, I don't know if you watched the video, I can forward you a clip of it. Representative Davis, very briefly to your bill before we go to the roll call.
Well, you know, House File 4095 is a bill to protect our most fundamental freedoms, the right to worship in peace. And we heard a lot about being in the moment. Well, Mission Church, Carlsbad, California, anti-Israel protesters repeatedly disrupted Christian-Jewish worship events and services. Wilshire Boulevard Temple, Los Angeles, California, December 3rd, 2025. Protesters entered the historic synagogue during an indoor community event co-hosted by Interfaith
Davis.
Partners. Cities Church, St. Paul, Minnesota.
Davis. We will go to the clerk will take the roll.
Novotny.
Yes.
Mohler.
No.
Witte.
Yes.
Feist.
No.
Berg.
No.
Bliss.
Yes.
Curran. Absent. Duren?
Yes.
Mangan?
Yes.
Greenman?
No.
Harder?
Yes.
Hollins?
No.
Hudson?
Yes.
Johnson?
No.
Pinto?
No.
Ream?
No.
Rapinski?
Yes.
Schwartz?
Yes.
Steer?
Yes.
Tabke?
No.
With 10 ayes and 9 nays, and under the chair power agreement, the bill does not pass. The next meeting will be March 24th, Tuesday 24th. Chair Moeller, you will have the gavel, and can you briefly describe what's going to be happening at the meeting?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So we'll have our normally scheduled committee time, and then in the we'll break for dinner, and then the evening we'll come back. It was agreed that we would have an evening hearing where we'll be hearing bipartisan bills. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. With no further business, the committee is adjourned.